American unity, the purpose of our organization of Afro-American unity, which has the same aim and objective, to fight whoever gets in our way. To bring about the complete independence of people of African descent here in the Western Hemisphere and first here in the United States, and bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary. That's our motto. The purpose of our organization is to start right here in Harlem, which has the largest concentration of people of African descent that exists anywhere on this earth. There are more Africans here in Harlem than exist in any city on the African continent, because that's what you and I are, Africans.
That's Malcolm X, 6 months before he was assassinated in the very same place in the Audubon Ballroom. Ilyasa, you were just two, but you were there with your mother and sisters when your father was gunned down. And every February 21st and May 19th, his birthday, at WBAI, where we began Democracy Now! And where I worked for decades, we would play your dad's speeches and talk to your mother, Dr. Betty Shabazz. And she talked about how the sound of his voice on the radio would echo through the rooms. Can you end by talking about the significance of your mother and your father together in raising you and the message they felt was most important and how they'd feel about what's happening today?
Yes, I have to say, Amy, it warms my heart. And you know, again, it's the reason that no matter where I am, when you ask me to come on your show, I don't think I'll ever say no to you. You know, my father provided the biggest critique of America with its insistence that America lives up to her promise of liberty and justice for all. I'm grateful that my parents had the love and support that they had in one another. My mother safeguarded her husband's legacy. Her home would be firebombed on February 14th, 1 week later. He would invite my mother and the babies to see him deliver his Federation on the Organization of Afro-American Unity as an extension of the Organization of African Unity for liberty and justice. And my mother would watch this horrific assassination, and my sisters and I, she was pregnant with twins, and she safeguarded her husband's legacy, not so that he could be famous, but for the benefit of future generations. He did extensive work, and we know the enormous threat that he posed. And I think when we address what really happened, then young people will be able to benefit from his work. He said that it would be this generation of young people who would recognize that those in power have misused it, and that they would demand change, and they would be willing to roll up their sleeves and do the necessary work. My father spoke truth. Truth is timeless. And so we are very happy that we will soon get the truth on who organized his assassination.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Ilyasa Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's six daughters, professor now at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, community organizer, activist, award-winning author of many books, and Ben Crump, civil rights attorney who's working with Malcolm X's family. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
RCT, In Sound, from Way Out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, first up is Professor Henry Giroux, who talks to us about the growing reality of fascism in America.
But he doesn't think we're past the point of no return.
Next up, we speak with Roger Harris, also on the question of fascism in America and what to do about it.
And he concludes that we need, in terms of strategy, we need our own political party.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. An American form of fascism is unfolding in our country. What exactly it is and what we can do to fight it is the question of the day. We see a massive political effort to legitimize and normalize white minority rule. Things are happening rapidly. Just a year ago, our Capitol was attacked pursuant to a plan to reverse the results of a presidential election. Soon, the Supreme Court will likely overrule the almost 50-year-old precedent set in the Roe v. Wade case on the question of a woman's right to control her own body. Voting rights have been and will continue to be extremely restricted, particularly in communities of color. Irrational and magical thinking has been legitimized. Over 900,000 people have unnecessarily died of COVID. There has developed in our country a culture of cruelty manifested by Trump, but initiated in CIA torture and detention camps for Muslim men and boys in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. It didn't start after 9/11 with the wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. It goes back further than that. America has been prosecuting wars abroad during our entire lifetimes. The provocations against Russia regarding NATO military encroachment on its borders are the latest chapter in almost continual and seemingly endless wars. A lesson of history since Greek and Roman times is that if you can't have imperialism abroad and democracy at home, well, you certainly can't do them both at the same time. We speak today with Professor Henry Giroux, who currently holds the McMaster University Chair for a scholarship in the public interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department. He has written many books, most recently The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and also the book American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely, our pleasure. Now, you write that there's no single version of fascism. Well, how would you characterize, then, the developing fascism in America and distinguish it, perhaps, from fascism as it developed in Germany or Italy or Spain?
No, I don't think that fascism is simply of one piece, but I do think there are certain principles that get updated and take on a particular form endemic to the country in which they're being produced, and I think there are a series of warning signs, particularly in the United States and in some cases across the globe. And one is the ultra-nationalism that we see everywhere now. The other is the emergence of white supremacy as a legitimate discourse. The other is that we see what I would call the claim that America is in decline. You see the elevation of instinct over emotion. You see the attempt to suppress dissent. You see the attempt, the contempt for weakness, the hypermasculinity, the culture of fear. I think the anti-intellectualism. I think what I call the politics of disposability and the claims of racial purity that we see. Also the emphasis on censorship, the rewriting of history in a way that seems to suggest that white nationalism is the only way that people can occupy, the only discourse available for people to occupy the public sphere. I think all of those issues basically represent a rebranded form of fascism that emerges through a particular lens of American culture that has now given us a warning sign about, you know, how they fundamentally echo the past.
Henry, you've written that,
quote, the lines between democracy and authoritarianism are collapsing, close quote. How can you demonstrate this?
Well, I'll tell you, one way to look at it is to look at the recent report from the Economist Intelligence Unit, which talks about the rise of the suppression of dissent in the United States, the collapse between the truth and misinformation, the cult of the strong man, the lies, the attack on civic culture, and of course, the increasing, and more than anything, the increasing use of violence as a political form to basically threaten, institute a culture of fear, and to appropriate and engage in the struggle for political power. I mean, the January 6th revolt, it seems, or insurrection, it seems to me, is a classic example of what I would call a counter-revolution. I mean, it's a counter-revolution going on in the United States. You know, it's an attempt to undo democracy, undo the Constitution, undo the rule of law in multiple ways. I mean, when you get a former president of the United States promising, when you get a president of the United States during his term, you know, offering pardons to criminals, I mean, claiming that treating the Justice Department as if it's its own personal lawyer, you know, trying to negotiate ways in which he could overturn the election, and then getting a Republican Party that absolutely endorses all of that stuff and believes in the big lie and goes so far as to claim that the insurrection itself was nothing more than an expression of legitimate political discourse. I think it's pretty clear that democracy is under siege, not to mention what he's done with the Supreme Court, which really seems to be now captured by a bunch of conservative thugs who have no understanding of what it means to take seriously the promise and the ideals of democracy, particularly around both voting rights and the reproductive assault on women's bodies. So I think, yeah, we can say that those institutions, those principles, those ideas that are meaningful in a democracy are beginning to collapse. Civic culture is collapsing in the United States. You know, civic culture is basically something supported by what I call a democratic formative culture, in which questions of community, justice, fairness, compassion, understanding, respect for the welfare state, respect for unions, respect for counter-opinions are really operative. And I think increasingly what we see is a war on all of those things. And they're not hard to discern. And I think in that sense, yes, democracy is on the decline in the United States, just as the Economist report pointed out a few weeks ago. It actually downplayed the United States from what it called a full democracy to a flawed democracy.
Yes, as have other organizations in the world, which rate and qualify how high or how low on the democracy scale nations are. Now, Henry, also, I wonder, we hear this word, you know, the term neoliberalism thrown around rather freely in this country. What is neoliberalism, and what role do you think it's been playing in preparing the ground for the seeds?
Neoliberalism is the most pernicious philosophy that has come along since the divine right of kings. And it basically emerged in the 1970s under Carter, but when Ronald Reagan married Margaret Thatcher, it became basically, and with the fall, of course, of the Berlin Wall, it became a full-fledged ideology that seemed to suggest that the only thing that really matters is the market, and that the market is not just an economy that concentrates wealth and power in the hands of few people, is a template for not only basically regulating the market, but regulating all of social life. And so it seems to me that what neoliberalism has done is that a number of things. It seems to suggest that the only thing that matters is unchecked individualism, harsh competition. It replaces the notion of the public good and all forms of solidarity with a kind of Benthian war of all against all. It puts a premium on competitive attitudes, degrades collaboration. It claims that markets should regulate themselves. It's absolutely wedded to a form of economic Darwinism in which privatization, commodification, deregulation are the mantras of how the market should work. And it privatizes everything. And I think that what we have seen under neoliberalism are two things. We've seen the increasing concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a financial elite. We've seen the emergence of massive inequality that is really a killing machine. We've also seen basically a pedagogy, an educational thrust that seems to suggest something very deadly, that all the problems that we face are individual problems, and that private troubles are basically just that. So any problems that we face, we have to face alone. That has produced a massive form of alienation, depoliticization, and it does something tragic to a democracy. It operates off the assumption that people can no longer translate private issues into larger social considerations, so they have no understanding of systemic problems and how they work.
Henry, you see our culture as shifting. Lenin once remarked on this phenomena. He said something to the effect that nothing happens for decades, then all of a sudden decades seem to happen in a few days. Would you share that observation?
I guess when Ronald Reagan made the declaration that government is really the problem and not the cure, something shifted. And what shifted was a discourse at the highest levels of power that's now said that capitalism was unchecked and that it could do anything it wanted. And all of a sudden, we saw an enormous assault on public goods, on unions, on schools. We saw a counter-revolution in the making, in which people were increasingly responding to the decades of democratization and protests that went on in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I think that we saw democracy in free fall, and it has never recovered, and it got worse. We saw the move from basically an investment in public goods to the rise of a financial elite in which money completely dictated politics. And so we saw a major collapse here around rights. While personal rights suffered and political rights, of course, suffered, voter suppression laws, as obvious, among other things, but social rights suffered, meaning that we now had a redefinition of freedom and justice and equality that were really their opposites. I mean, freedom meant the freedom to do anything you want. Justice meant don't address the questions of injustice. Social responsibility meant, you know, by the neoliberal mantra that economic activity should be divorced from social cost. And what that meant is you no longer had to think about ethics anymore. So in that sense, there was a real shift in the culture, yes. And there was also an increasing shift in higher education and public education, which has always been a laboratory for democracy. I mean, you know and I know what happened after 1980. All of a sudden, the universities became corporatized. And all of a sudden, 70% of the faculty was no longer tenured. There was a massive assault on academic freedom. Many of them lost their jobs, lost their benefits, and it no longer became a center of, in my estimation, of struggle. The great public intellectuals today are not academics, they're journalists. And I think that, you know, we lost that critical culture that was so central to the 60s and the 80s, along with the institutions that informed it.
Now, I wonder, Henry, too, would you agree that we've been witnessing in recent times a massively increasing political effort to, well, legitimize and normalize white majority rule?
I think that's a fabulous question. I really do. And I can't tell you how much how important that is. Yes, but I'm going to just qualify that a bit. It's not white minority rule. It's white supremacist rule. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest here. You know, this is really about keeping people of color, brown people, black people, out of the democratic process. And it's done in ways that uses the language of white supremacy, white nationalism, and outright and overt racism. We've seen it with Trump. We see it with the Republican Party. We see it with policies that are... Can you imagine? You and I now live in... the United States is now a country that says that school teachers, if they talk about slavery, or if they talk about injustices in the past, they could be fired, fined, or who knows, punished by viewing such behavior as criminal behavior. Does that remind you of something? Do you have to be a rocket scientist to not recognize that we saw the same thing in the 1930s in Germany? You know, when all of a sudden certain forms of knowledge were considered debased and corrupted and they burned books in the name of racial purity? I mean, this is white supremacy unadulterated. There's no other way to talk about that. It's not simply white minority rule. It's white minority rule in the interest of racial cleansing. First you burn books, then you burn intellectuals, then you burn bodies.
Henry, please talk about the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, and then the attack on women's reproductive rights, the attack on voting rights, and the attack on racial justice.
They're all connected. And I think that what they're connected by, not the fact that they're expressions of a Republican majority sort of hating all of those things. They're connected because they're part of a counter-revolution. They're part of a counter-revolution that recognizes that wherever justice and freedom emerge in terms of a collective effort to deepen and expand the possibilities of democracy, it has to be shut down. And that's exactly what they're doing. This is a counter-revolution that believes in violence, not just violence in the way that we saw given the attack on the Capitol, which is an attempt to both legitimate Trump and the cult of leadership in that form of particular form of fascism. But it's also an attack on education. It's also an attack on women's bodies. It's also an attack on justice. It's an attack on all those areas in which people may have some control over their political, social, and political rights. And so I think in that sense, we're not just dealing with a minor insurrection. Oh, I'm sorry. We're not just dealing with an insurrection that's almost unthinkable in terms of what happened in an attempt to legitimate it. What we're dealing with is a full throttle, full-fledged attack on democracy. That's what we're dealing with. I mean, you know and I know. In the 70s, you know, you had the Powell memo, you had the Trilateral Commission talking about the excess of democracy. That was a warning. They wanted to fight that battle in the realm of ideas, and they did. But with, of course, the Heritage Foundation and all kinds of conservative institutions emerging, Fox News, the social media. But this is different. This attack on democracy operates under the threat of force, under the threat of outright censorship, and under the threat of the language of white supremacy. To put it bluntly, you know, having studied critical theory all my life, you know, I think it was Horkheimer who once said, you want to study fascism, then you better look at capitalism quite carefully.
Well, following up on that, Henry, I want you to talk a bit about that in this context. I mean, you've got guys like Charles Koch and others, you know, funding the Republican Party, funding God knows how many other right-wing projects in the country. Talk to us a bit about the relationship between big business and the growth of fascism.
I think there are, thank you again for a great question. I think there are a couple of things. I think that with the financial crisis of 2009, something became obvious. And what became obvious was that neoliberalism failed. It failed on its promises. It was going to lift the boat. Everybody, you know, it was going to redistribute wealth. Everybody was going to be happy. Everybody would have jobs. You know, security would be somehow taken care of. We wouldn't have to worry about unions. You know, the private sector could operate more efficiently than the public sector. Well, this was all nonsense. And so since it couldn't defend itself any longer in terms of the promises that it had put forth, it turned to something else. It turned to fascism, a fascist politics in which it now blamed blacks. It now blamed immigrants. It now blamed Muslims. It now blamed the people who believed in the common good. And in doing that, it seems to me that it opened up for corporations and the financial elite, particularly those on the right. This doesn't include all corporations, and it doesn't include all of the corporate elite, but the hard right corporate elite, the Koch brothers, you know, people, Peter Thiel, you know, a whole range of these, Elon Musk. These are corporate thugs, you know, and they really believe that profit above all absolutely has to be sustained through a logic that says that the government should in no way interfere with what they do. This is Milton Friedman on steroids. That's what this is. But it's not Milton Friedman simply on steroids. It's the Milton Friedman who supported Pinochet. It's the Milton Friedman who believed that dictatorships provide more opportunities for corporations than democracies do. And that's what we're seeing now.
For our listeners who just tuned in, we're speaking with Professor Henry Giroux. Henry, do you think that we're past the point of no return? And if not, what good things do you see developing on our side?
I don't think we're ever past the point of no return. There was resistance even in the camps. I mean, I think there are a lot of hopeful signs. I mean, particularly among young people. I mean, I think that young people, teachers, are really mobilizing in a way that suggests that they no longer want to be written out of the script of democracy. And they're also realizing that in many ways they now inhabit a culture of such overt violence without apology that they can't fight this alone. And so, you know, we see young people, of course, protesting against violence, school violence. We see teachers walking out of schools because their roles have been diminished. You know, but I do, and of course, there's a women's rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, along with other black movements and brown movements. These are very powerful movements, and they offer enormous hope. The only thing is they suffer from two problems that have to be overcome. And one is they really need to stop being fractionalized and unite in a mass party that's able to be systemically organized to put pressure in ways that bring power to bear to stop this fascist politics that we're engulfed in. Secondly, they need to take education seriously. I mean, one of the things that we've learned from the convoy movement in Canada, increasingly now coming to the United States, is that social messaging matters. The media matters. It's a massive educational machine that can function in the interest of domination or the interest of liberation. I mean, it can change consciousness and it can destroy it. And I think in many ways, you know, those two issues have to come together. We need to bring people together in a mass movement, a mass social movement, uniting these different factions without denying the importance of the forms of oppression that they point to. And secondly, we need a massive educational movement that takes popular education seriously and really knows how to use the media to be able to speak to people in a language they understand and in which they can recognize themselves and in which they can rethink the conditions under which they find themselves.
I wonder too, Henry, certainly it would seem the Republican Party or great portions of it have endorsed and embraced the violence of January 6th. Violence is, as I think you've talked about and written about, endemic to fascism, is it not? Talk to us a bit about what you, I think, have called many signposts that give rise to this kind of violence and how it becomes normalized.
Well, I think it becomes normalized when it becomes repeated endlessly and treated as entertainment or just treated as news without any serious analysis of what causes it and what the underlying logics and forces are that produce it. I mean, violence is the DNA of American culture. It's everywhere. We're an increasingly militarized society, and I think that if you want to point to one central element that's caused it, it's very simple in my mind, and that is, as the social state declines, and we can't address social problems by getting at their roots and dealing with them in ways that address them, then we criminalize those problems. And when we start to criminalize those problems, criminalize poverty, homelessness, the kinds of problems that young people face in schools, you have a massive expansion of what I call the punishing state. This is called creeping punishment. And that creeping punishment is endemic to fascism. And it's endemic to supporting politics of terror and domestic terrorism, in which violence becomes the organizing principle by which we both organize society and use it to address the problems that we address. It's about the exhaustion of neoliberalism. It has no answers anymore. And so we have to resort to violence and increase the punishing state, the carceral state, in order to deal with this stuff. That's why you have, I mean, think about it. Last year, the police killed more people than they have in the last 10 years. I mean, over 1,000 people were killed by the police. I mean, you have a system out of control in terms of not having the social supports, not having a society that provides social provisions, not having a society that addresses massive, massive inequality. I mean, inequality is a killer. It's a form of necropolitics, and it's run rampant. It's unchecked right now in American society.
Do you believe the Democratic Party can be trusted to do a good job in defending us? Sheldon Wolin called the Democratic Party the inauthentic opposition. And right now they've been supine. They refuse to mobilize the American people. What are your thoughts about that?
No, I think we have two parties. One party is basically the strong party of Wall Street, and the other party is the weak party of Wall Street. I mean, they're both wedded to Wall Street. I mean, they're centrist liberals who don't believe in the distribution of wealth, who don't believe that capitalism and democracy are not the same, who don't believe that in some fundamental way the system doesn't work, that you want to put Band-Aids on the system. And then when they get attacked, like all liberals, you know, the definition of liberalism that I always love of liberals is that when a fight breaks out, they leave the room. You know, that was Obama, right? I mean, he left the room.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do more to please the right. They're more afraid of the right than they are the left. And it seems to me that translates into something horrendous, because a centrist today in the United States, in Europe, would be on the far right. They wouldn't be called centrist. They'd be called the far right. I mean, Biden, what does he do? I mean, beyond this infrastructure bill, I mean, does he talk about free education? Does he talk about universal health care? Does he talk about redistributing wealth? He doesn't talk about any of these things. I mean, and he's going to be defeated in 2024. No question in my mind. He'll be defeated. The Democrats are too weak. They're not justified. And they have people in the party who basically are Republicans, who are Republicans in drag.
Henry, as we speak, there are, I don't know how many trucks basically over the last couple of weeks brought government more or less to a standstill in Canada. And now they're lined up in my old hometown, Detroit, at the Ambassador Bridge, stopping traffic now from going over there. They're talking about coming down to the Super Bowl, having a whole cross-country parade of trucks. So far, nobody's figured out how to stop them or what to do about it. How should we read this? How should we see this?
I think this is a counter-revolutionary movement that's taken the notion of freedom right out of the neoliberal handbook and so abused it that basically it's now attracted it's attracted white supremacists, neo-Nazis, you know, people who basically have no concern for the common good, anti-vaxxers, a lot of conspiracy theorist types. I think it needs to be named for what it is. They have a great social messaging system. They have the instruments to basically wage a massive strike, and they're doing it in the name of the abuse of freedom. I mean, this is a full-fledged, unadulterated attack on the common good. That's what it is. This isn't about freedom. This is about the death of democracy. And I think that what we see here is an inability of the mainstream and liberal press to really unpack this for what it is. This is not just about, you know, doing away with mass vaccinations. This is not just about repudiating public health officials. This is an attack on on government responsibility. This is an attack on social justice, and this is an attack on the public good. That's what it is, and it's got to be named that way. I'm not sure how this is going to be resolved without engaging in massive violence occurring. But I'll tell you, it's far more frightening than the insurrection of January 6th, in my mind.
I agree.
It's far more frightening. It really is. It's a playbook now for the right. And they're going to engage us in every way they can to basically shut down this democracy, whatever's left of it. So I would say these are very dangerous times, and the convoy is symptomatic of that.
Thank you, Henry, for that. Sadly, I agree with you.
We've come to the end of our allotted time, Henry. I wanted to ask you if you could tell our audience how people can follow your work. It's Henry Giroux, G-I-R-O-U-X. Henry, how can people follow your work?
I have a website where I put all my work, and it's www.henryagiroux.com.
We hope you'll come back. We truly appreciated what you've had to teach us today. Thank you, Henry Giroux. You take it easy.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for the great questions.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The January 6th event last year was a peculiar kind of coup, not one that would install an authoritarian figure, but one that was designed to keep such a guy in his job. It almost worked, but not quite. Trump had support, but not enough in the right places. There wasn't enough support for him in the military, the national security establishment, nor in the corporate elite or in the media. But that doesn't mean that we are out of danger. We are seeing the success of a creeping hometown Christianized form of fascism in our country, a peculiar American form. 150 million people, after all, live in red states. The far right has seized local politics. The majority of legislatures and governorships in 22 states are Republican, not Democrat. 19 states have passed voter suppression and voter nullification laws as documented by the Brennan Center. In the face of this, the Democratic Party has been supine. They will not mobilize the American people. The late political philosopher Sheldon Wolin has called the Democratic Party, and I quote, the inauthentic opposition, close quote. The Democrats function as a junior partner of the Republicans, if you will. As Noam Chomsky has stated, the January 6th events show that the, quote, limited political democracy that still exists is hanging by a delicate thread, close quote. The Republicans have rejected democracy, and that's with a small d. Well, what are the reasons for the growth of Christian fascism? What might be in store for us? What is to be done? Today, we will discuss the central question of political life with our guest, Roger D. Harris. Roger D. Harris is closely affiliated with the Task Force of the Americas and the U.S. Peace Council. He is a leader of the California Peace and Freedom Party, the only socialist party in the state to hold ballot status. Well, Roger Harris, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
Let's start this way. You wrote, and I quote, their attempt to influence the electoral process by disruption did not and could not really have led to the seizure of power, close quote. It has since been revealed that Trump had a 38-page plan that was circulated in the White House to overturn the vote in order to stay in power, but Vice President Mike Pence would not go along with the plan. 11 people have been indicted for seditious conspiracy far in this connection. I wonder, have you revised your thinking on this in any way as these January 6th hearings and other news has brought us new facts?
Right. Like the parable of the blind man describing an elephant, there are many interpretations of what happened that fateful day. So note that when I wrote my article, I said, quote, while myths are prone to hyperbole, they all are not necessarily false. So let me quickly respond to your question, but suggest that we not get bogged down into the litmus test of whether or not it's a coup, and get into some of the more trenchant questions of what it represents, how it came about, and how it's been used. So the 11 indictments for seditious conspiracy, those are pretty slim pickings after over a year of what was heralded as, quote, the most expansive federal law enforcement investigation in U.S. history. And as this radio program, which is a leading advocate of civil liberties, we should also not abandon that tradition of presumptive innocence until proven guilty. Now, the 38-page PowerPoint calls for the overturning of the people's will, which is very underhanded, but at least by my reading, it's entirely within constitutional bounds. It's lawfare, but it's not a coup. The PowerPoint makes some really nutty claims about Chinese interference in the U.S. presidential elections, but that reflects the similarly nutty claims made by leading Democrats after the 2016 presidential election about, quote, Russia hacked voting systems in 39 states. So recall back then in 2016, 2017, that the pro-democratic party, The Atlantic, ran an article after Election Day in 2016, but before the Electoral College met, and that article was entitled, The Electoral College was Meant to Stop Men Like Trump from Being President. And The Atlantic argued that the electors should defy the voters and appoint Hillary Clinton president. So we've had precedent for this. It's kind of a repeat of what we saw in 2016. I don't think it rises to a level of a coup.
Roger, do you think the American political regime is unraveling?
Let me quote the great African liberation leader, Julius Nyerere. And he quipped, the United States is a one-party state. But with typical American extravagance, they have two of them. And in the lead up to the 2016 U.S. presidential election, we saw two genuine grassroots political insurgencies. One was the Trump on the right and Sanders on the left. But both were absorbed into the electoral politics of the two major parties. So my view is that as long as that dynamic exists, there is no reason for the ruling elites to change their manner of governance. The two-party system is a marvelous arrangement for the ruling elites because it allows contention on cultural and very limited economic issues while preserving a bedrock consensus on militarism, the surveillance and security state, and a combination of austerity for working people and welfare for the wealthy and the corporations.
Absolutely, absolutely. I wonder, though, do you think that the limited democracy, which we now have and certainly is limited, is, as some have suggested, hanging by a thread? You know, many historians and political pundits are saying that given the change in the voting laws in so many states, including how electors are assigned, the stage is being set for a final collapse of American democracy following the 2024 presidential election. Do you think that's an accurate assessment or not?
Yeah. Your point about how electors are assigned is well taken. It may be profoundly undemocratic the way they're chosen, but it is fully constitutional, and neither of the major parties are contending that. Behind the facade of a formal procedural democracy is the lurking danger of the erosion of our ability to exercise real democracy. That is, the erosion of civil liberties, which, in my opinion, are, as you would say, hanging by a thread. The national security state agencies monitor everything we do on our computers, everything we say on our phones. This has occurred under both Democrats and Republicans, and neither has done anything to stop it.
What is fascism, and what would an American version of fascism possibly look like?
Right, so the fascism is sometimes used as like a cudgel. Like, if you don't like somebody, you call them a fascist. I don't see fascism as a personality disorder. Just because Mr. Trump is white and has an unpleasant personality, at least projects one to me, and has right-leaning politics, does not necessarily make him a fascist. There's much more to what fascism is, in my opinion. Analogies of Trump to Hitler may be misleading. While material conditions for many Americans are distressing, they are not as dire as they were in Weimar Germany under Hitler's time, which in Weimar Germany, there was an absolute economic collapse. Similarly, the Proud Boys and people like that, they don't approximate the hundreds of thousands of trained and armed paramilitaries that were under Hitler's direct command. Most important, the mass working class, communist, and socialist parties of Weimar Germany were positioned to contend for state power, while trade unions and third parties challenging the bourgeois rule are in decline in the U.S. today. So I would say that under fascism, the capitalist class voluntarily cedes a degree of economic decision-making to a dictatorial state in exchange for guarantees of public order and promises to keep their profits. As long as any serious challenge to that power is absent, the U.S. ruling elites have little incentive to resort to those measures, at least the way I see that. Fixating on the neo-fascist politics, so to speak, that define the Republican Party under Trumpism, so to speak, distracts from other threats. January 6th, in my opinion, is being used by those currently in power to justify further expansion of the security state. And that further expansion of the security state has and will continue to be used against people like us.
I wonder, Chris Hedges, as you probably know, thinks that we're experiencing a what he calls a Christian fascism. I wonder how you feel about that. He thinks it's had some success. What are your thoughts on this business of Christian of fascism and whether or not, in fact, it has realized any success as of yet?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Chris Hedges. I learn a lot from him. He has a different worldview than I do. He has a somewhat dark and psychological and moralistic worldview, but I really like him. And it just turned out that I was just rereading him this morning. So on Christian fascism, or what I would call white supremacy, it's really the foundation of this nation. The Pilgrims, when we think about it, they were straight up Christian fascists. I know that you've had programs with Glenn Ford, I believe, with Black Agenda Report, the late Glenn Ford. And he wrote an incredibly good article that I recommend on that whole issue of the Pilgrims and Christian fascism. It's called The American Thanksgiving, Rejoicing in Genocide and White Supremacy. That came out in 2006. We have to recall that for Native Americans whose ancestral lands were expropriated by the European settlers as part of a brutal process of displacement and extermination, there's nothing new. And we recall that for African Americans whose forebears were brought here as chattel slaves and upon whose labor much of the wealth of the nation was accumulated, this is something that is not new. And we recall that we should recall the internment of the West Coast Japanese, which was a project of the arguably most liberal president in all of U.S. history. Another incident I would bring up and compare it to January 6th, and that is July 1925. Then 100,000 Ku Klux Klan marched on the White House. So the view of this nation as a shining city on the hill, as Reagan put it, until those damned racist working class people, as some liberals would put it, were stirred up by the fascist Trump, is based on American exceptionalism. White supremacy didn't originate with Trump, although he does abet it. But let me add another thing, because there's a flip side to this. The successes of anti-racist efforts like Black Lives Matter movement must be recognized. They mounted the largest mass demonstrations in all of U.S. history. Part of the perception of growing white supremacy is a commendable increased awareness and reporting of this national blight and the growing movement in opposition. Where there is oppression, there is opposition. The one-sided focus on white supremacy fails to credit the fight back of people of color, portraying them as victims without also celebrating their agency. The Black Lives Matter movement, for example, was a truly national uprising against white supremacy, and all the more remarkable because it involved significant white participation and it reverberated internationally.
Yes, I totally agree with you, Roger. Roger, I just wanted to remind our listeners that the late Glenn Ford, just before he died, finished the manuscript of a book called The Black Agenda, and that's been published by Orr Books, and the article that you cite on Thanksgiving is the first article of The Black Agenda. So for listeners who want to get that, they can get it from Orr Books, O-R, called orrbooks.com. Now, I wanted to ask you this, Roger. Under what circumstances would the ruling elite in the USA take up the option of fascist rule, and why do you think we're not there yet?
I think fascism comes about when they can't rule the way they're ruling right now. And there's every reason that we see that they continue to rule quite successfully the way they have. A crisis may be impending, but it hasn't reached us yet. The insurgencies of both the Sanders people and the Trump people were contained within the two-party system. And as long as that facade of bourgeois democracy can be continued, they have no incentive to go to some sort of other form that is even more authoritarian.
Mm-hmm. Also, Mr. Harris, you make the point, I think, that the focusing on the GOP, the Republican Party, as the bad cop, gets us in all sorts of problems, that the Democratic Party is simply the lesser evil and therefore more acceptable. Explain that notion to us.
Yeah, I've used that analogy that the Republican Party is part of the bad cop, good cop dyad, which is the political leadership of the U.S. empire. Now, my view is that the empire is the biggest threat to humanity and not one part of that dyad or another. So by focusing all the animus on one component of the ruling duopoly, it tends to render the duopoly itself, that is, the two-party system of capitalist rule, invisible. Demonizing the bad cop does not eliminate the system, but only renders the presumptive lesser evil more cosmetically acceptable.
So how are the January 6th events being used to justify further expansion of the security state, which has and will continue to be used against us on the left?
Right. And I think this is a really core question, so I really appreciate you asking that. After the Democrats lost the presidency in 2016 to as repugnant a figure as Donald Trump, they conjured up the alibi of Russian interference in the election and milked that for 4 years. We remember that. Now the Democrats can no longer plausibly claim that Vladimir Putin is pulling the strings in the White House. So the January 6th incident has become the ruse of convenience for retaining the presidency and congressional majorities without offending their donors, the Democratic Party donors, by doing something significant for their voter base. But let me continue, because my fear is that the rush by the ruling powers, particularly the Democrats, to prevent right popular insurgencies such as January 6th, that rush and that their actions will be used to suppress left political insurgencies like the Occupy movement. I was participating in the Occupy movement, and I would say that some of the charges that are made against the 11 who have just been indicted, boy, those could have been made against the Occupy movement very easily. And out here, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. We now have the Capitol Police in the San Francisco Bay Area. That doesn't make me feel any safer, and it does nothing to address the root problem of why a popular right-wing insurgency arose in the first place. So in short, I'm concerned about, in the words of William Kunstler, I'm concerned with the emerging police state. The response to a right political insurgency would be twofold. The correct response for a right political insurgency should be twofold. First, we need to build a popular left political insurgency independent of the two parties of capital. And two, we need to address the dispossession and precarity that's inherent in our current neoliberal regime that fuels the right insurgency. So that would be my response.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of Noam Chomsky, as we have a couple of times, I guess, now in this broadcast, he has made the point more than once that climate change and nuclear war are the two existential issues, if you will, that threaten us most of all, and that they've been obscured somewhat by what has gone on in the country. What is it that you think are the major factors that don't allow the American citizens and the people really to zero in as much as they should on these two existential threats?
Right. And I think there's a whole range of things. I know Chomsky says that these are the top two. And
yeah.
I think it's exciting to have like a top two list of the 10 worst things that can happen to the world. But there is a whole constellation of issues that are being obscured. The smoke over the wrangling over the minutia of Build Back Better obfuscates the fact that a world record defense budget, greater than even the Pentagon requested, passed in a heartbeat. The squabble over masking distracts from the failure of the world's richest nation to provide universal health care in a time of pandemic. The issues that truly affect the future of humanity are obscured by the fog of cultural wars that divide working people. And meanwhile, the state security and surveillance measures become more pervasive, and even the nominally more liberal party of the ruling class is ending up championing the FBI, CIA, and NSA. So I think these are the problems, that we have a superficial polarity within the public theater of politics, but we have a bedrock consensus over the class issues at the top with amongst the ruling class.
As we begin to come to the end, sadly, of this interview, I would be curious to know any final or further thoughts that you have, perhaps questions we've neglected to ask you that you'd like to talk about. But give us some final thoughts, if you would, please, on your thinking about all of these issues, where perhaps we go from here. And also, please, let our listeners know where they can find your work. It's work that everybody in this country should be, frankly, reading and familiarizing themselves with. You can let us know and let our listeners know how to follow your work and the work of others, perhaps, that you think are critically important to be considered at this time.
Yeah, well, thank you for all your questions. And, of course, thank you for the great work that your program does. I think we're in an interesting inflection point right now. There is a contradiction out there, a contradiction between what's going on and what is happening behind the scenes. We really do have like a dictatorship of the ruling elites, and I think people understand that, but they don't actually use that term. They use the term, they say, well, everything is run by the rich and powerful corporations. But that really is understanding that our democracy really is not, it's a procedural democracy, but not a democracy that rules and the rules for the major people, the majority of working people. And I think also we have to add a lot of people who have small businesses. You just have to walk downtown and you see that whole class of people is being obliterated. So we're in the sort of situation where everybody is putting their faith in one of the other of the major political parties, but they are not solving our problems, and they are united actually in not solving our problems. So we have a crisis legitimacy, but it has not yet matured into a political form, and that's what we are looking forward to, a political form of a left insurgency which will take over from the old system that is corrupt and dying. So, and then you ask, like, where do I write? You could find my writings in the Orinoco Tribune, Counterpunch, Mint Press News, Dissident Voice, and other places. So thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Believe me, it's been our pleasure.
Thank you, Roger Harris. You've articulated the situation that we find ourselves in extremely well. We're grateful to you, and I thank you on behalf of our listeners, who will be grateful to you also when they listen to our show. You take it easy, Roger.
Thank you, sir.
Goodbye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
That a certain distance from power is essential to the integrity of intellectual work. Second, an oppositional outlook helps. Neither Said, nor Foucault, nor Chomsky, nor Gramsci would be the intellectuals if their disposition was not critical.
That's Iqbal Ahmed, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Iqbal Ahmed on intellectuals, ideology, and the state. What role do intellectuals play in society? Are they apparatchiks, yes men and women? Or do they challenge the half-truths, mendacities, and fabrications of the rich and powerful? Noam Chomsky explored these themes in his famous essay, The Responsibility of Intellectuals, published in the New York Review of Books during the height of U.S. aggression in Indochina. Chomsky unambiguously declared, "It is the responsibility of intellectuals to speak the truth and expose lies." He called them the new mandarins, who are subservient to the ruling class and use their privileged position to advance their careers. They provide the cover for the crimes of state, articulating the underpinning and embedded ideology. For their services, they are well rewarded, with endowed chairs at the best universities, frequent media appearances, and fat book contracts. In this program, Iqbal Ahmed examines the work of intellectuals such as Chomsky, Antonio Gramsci, Edward Said, Rabindranath Tagore, and others, and the relationship of knowledge to power. Our guest today is Iqbal Ahmed of Pakistan. He was one of the Third World's most astute and innovative thinkers and anti-imperialists. He led an extraordinary life of engaged activism across continents, and was a mentor and a continuing influence on many. He taught at Hampshire College in Amherst. His articles and essays appeared in major international journals and magazines. He wrote a weekly column for Dawn, Pakistan's oldest English-language newspaper. He spoke at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on October 16, 1998. This was to be the last public talk he ever gave. He died in Islamabad, Pakistan, in May 1999. And now, Iqbal Ahmed.
Mana has asked me to talk about the intellectuals' ideologies and the state. The first major figure in writing about intellectuals and their responsibility is, of course, Julian Banda. Most of you are familiar with his La Trahison des Clercs, The Treason of Intellectuals. Writing in 1927, he argued about the risks of the intellectuals' subservience to ideology. He was important also for identifying nationalism as the multipurpose ideology and one that would mobilize as well for war as for imperialism, for capitalism no less than fascism, for liberalism no less than racism. Mobilized national passions, he argued, devastate social life, suck even remote villages into the ravages of war, so that war is no longer